Good morning. There I am. When my little church plant sang that song for the first time, I thought, I need that tattooed on my body where I can see it every day. To this I hold, my shepherd will defend me. He will defend me through any valley I go through. To this I hold. Because you and I, we go through so many valleys, so many shadows of death. And we need to know that our shepherd stands beside us, that he holds a stick in his hand to beat back the wolves, and that he will defend us until the very end. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning. This is quite possibly my favorite chapter in all of Scripture. So I know what time I'm supposed to end, and I'm going to try really hard to stick to that time. Because, and I didn't get to share a lot with this you that last night, but I do hope you get the book. Only because I've been able to give you little glimpses into the Gospel of John, but I spent 450 hours studying this book for my own heart. Because I grew up in the church. I'm a pastor's kid. I grew up very familiar with all these truths. But at 30 years old, I realized I harbored a cynical and fearful heart within my chest. And I wasn't really sure that my shepherd would defend me. I didn't think he was that good. I looked around and saw pain everywhere. I saw fear and doubt in my own heart, and I wasn't sure how I felt about God. And I was part of a national ministry and on staff at a church at that time. So you can't really like walk into work one day and be like, I'm not really sure how I feel about God. Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. So I knew that I needed to change, and I knew the only way back to his heart was through his son. And so I spent 450 hours poring over this gospel, because every page of this book tells you one thing: your God is for you, and he stands beside you, and he defends you all the time, even when you can't see him. And it's in those moments, that's what we're going to talk about today, it's in the moments of doubt and fear when God seems to be taking his sweet time, and we are stuck in the waiting, that we need to know that these things are true about him, not just here, but deep in here too. And this is the chapter that sealed the deal for me. And so I just love it. I have real deep affection for Martha and Mary in this story. And so you have your chapter printed out here. I am going to go ahead and let you know, we're not going to read this whole thing, but I did want you to have it to be able to refer to later if you wanted to go back and kind of pick your way through this a little more deeply and with the discussion questions. I want to give you a little bit of a setting, because the setting in all of these stories is going to be really important for us understanding them. When we saw Jesus last night, he was towards the very beginning of his ministry. And now we are picking back up in John chapter 11. So we are towards the end. We are getting into the final weeks of Jesus's life. So today at lunch, we're going to talk about an event that happens in the last week of his life. And so we are getting towards the end of his earthly ministry. And Jesus has been doing amazing things. And it's interesting, the Gospel of John only records 7 miracles that Jesus does. Because John, he's writing this as an old man. He knows Matthew, Mark, and Luke have already covered all the details. And so he's saying, what are the 7 things I want people to cling to about him? And he matches these 7 miracles with these 7 I am statements of Jesus. So Jesus says, I am the bread of life, and then he feeds the multitudes. We see all these beautiful stories that are matched with these I am statements. And in every single one of them, Jesus is saying, you know that I am that Moses met back in the early days of your history? I am he. I am the I am. And now I've come to show you what I'm truly like. And so Jesus is revealing the heart of his Father through all of these things. And for the most part, this is lost on the masses. They have no clue that he's claiming to be equal with God, that he's claiming to be the Son of God, that he's one with God. But it is not lost on the religious rulers. They understand exactly what he's saying. And in the chapter right before this one, in chapter 10, when he's at the Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus is teaching. And one of the Pharisees stands up and says, or one of the scribes stands up and says, you act like you're better than our father Abraham. And Jesus looks at him and he says, that's because before Abraham was, I am. And he's claiming equality with God. He is saying, this is who I am. And they get it, and they call it blasphemy, and they try to kill him in that moment. So Jesus pulls away, and that's the setting for this story. He pulls away. He's several days outside of Jerusalem waiting for his father to tell him that it's time, waiting for his hour because he knows the next time he steps into Jerusalem, it will be for one purpose and one purpose only. He knows that he was never meant to die a death as easy as stoning, but that his death would be far more cruel, and he's waiting for that moment to come. And so that's where we find Jesus in this waiting period. And while he's waiting, he gets a message from Mary and Martha. So let's pick up here in John 11, verse 1. Dramatic pause while I drink. All right. Now, a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sister sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." And the disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?" And Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." After saying these things, he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him." And the disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there, that you may believe, but let us go to him." So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." Let's pause there, and let's just talk about what we've read. I know that if you were listening, and I tried to emphasize this as I was reading, it says, Martha sent a message, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." Okay, can we just pause there? Wouldn't it be great to live with Jesus and be the one that he loved? And it's funny because there's actually a lot of people who think they were the one he loved. Because there's a trick to that. Every one of us is his favorite. That's kind of fun. All right, so he whom you love is ill. And it says, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he rushed off to heal him. No. He healed him from afar like he did in chapter 4 with the little boy who was sick. No. What does it say? He stayed. He waited. 2 days. We have to stop and pause here because the text takes us here. Sometimes, when we're in pain, God waits. And we can't understand that. We have only one perspective in this life, and it is our own. And we process all of life through our lens and our understanding. And I love that this passage doesn't even apologize for the waiting. It just says it. And I love what we learn here from this. I want to give you just a little bit of background because we haven't read the whole passage yet. If Jesus had left right when he had gotten the message, Lazarus still would have died. He was 4 days away. And when he arrives, on the day that he leaves, he arrives, and we're going to see this in this passage. Lazarus has been in the tomb 4 days. Now, this was intentional. It says Jesus loved them, so he waited. In consequence of this love, because he loved them, he waited. And it's very interesting, as you're piecing all of this together, 2 days later, he stands up and says, "It's time to go. My friend Lazarus has died." For 2 days, Jesus was waiting himself. When he sensed in his spirit that his friend had died, he stands up and says, "Now it's time to go." Now, we will struggle to understand this probably because we're not Jewish readers and we're not culturally in tune with what's happening here. But there was a belief at the time, because they didn't have the same technology that we have that can explain things like comas or people who appear to be dead. I kind of think of, I always think of the Princess Bride, mostly dead, someone who's mostly dead. So they didn't have the technology to explain certain medical phenomena. So they believed at the time that when you died, they would leave you out for 3 days. They would sit vigil with you because they believed that the spirit would hover over your body looking for a way to get back in. And if Jesus had come on day 1, 2, or 3, they would have called that a resuscitation. But after day 3, you gave up all hope and you wrapped that body in linen cloths, and you put it in a tomb, and you sealed that tomb with a stone. So on day four, Lazarus had already started to rot, and they wrapped him up, put him in a tomb, and sealed it. They gave up all hope. Jesus tells us in this story, I'm glad that I wasn't there so that you might believe. What did Jesus need them to know about him? They needed to know that their God was a resurrector, not a resuscitator. They needed to know that their God could reach his hand into the very heart of death and pull out his friend. That their God could undo decay and death. They needed to know this about him. Why? Because just in a few short weeks, his body would be impaled with a spear. His heart would be broken, and blood and water would wash out, and they would wrap his body and put him in a tomb and give up all hope. They needed to know that he could undo the worst thing. And this story would have come back to them later. They don't get it now. But right here, can we just stop? And can we acknowledge that you and I, we see this much of the narrow lane of time. And we judge him by what we see. But to our God, he sees all of eternity. And everything he does is for your good. Because he loves you. And you and I, we can't always understand that. Jesus says here that this death has occurred so that you might see his glory. And I know growing up in a Presbyterian church, I was taught from day one, from babyhood, that I existed for two things, to give glory to God. Hold on, wait, I missed it. Okay. What's chief purpose? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. Thanks. I started in the wrong order, so I got confused. All right. We're taught that our chief purpose in life is to glorify God. But when we go through pain, that is rarely a good enough reason for us, right? Let's just be honest. Can we all kind of say, okay, thank you. I see some heads nodding. It's not just me. But that's because we don't understand what that word means. You and I often think of glory as somehow like giving God credit, and that's a part of that. But when Jesus, throughout the whole Gospel of John, talks about glorifying his Father, it means one thing to his heart. It means revealing to the people around him something about his Father that they did not already know, but that they absolutely were going to need to know to get through the next few weeks. Next few years, for the rest of their life, they needed to hold on to this thing. They needed to be able to say, for this I know, my shepherd will protect me. There are things in life that you and I need to hold on to that we will only find in pain. And I wish it weren't that way. But in this broken world, that is how it is. And so can we wait with one who waits with us in our pain, who is revealing to us his glory, showing us what his heart is like in the middle of our pain? And can that be enough? It's okay right now to say, I'm not sure, because the rest of the passage is going to teach us that it is. So let's keep going. Let's pick back up where we left off. Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, but even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. And Martha said, I know he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? And she said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. We find Martha in a place of tension. I love this, because this is where you and I live most of the time, in this place of tension where we want to believe who God is, but we have this real pain and this real disappointment, and we're trying to hold those two things together. And I love what Martha does. She comes to him and she grieves before him. She doesn't come to him and say, you know what, I shouldn't have bothered you. I should have just let things play out how they were going to play out. You're a really busy man. I shouldn't have called you. She doesn't dumb down what she wanted. But she also doesn't come to him and say, you should have been here. You loved him.
Why did you let him die? She doesn't accuse him, and she doesn't let go of her longing either. She brings her longing and her disappointment and her pain and her faith. Because she says, even now I know God will give you whatever you ask. She's saying, you didn't do this thing I wanted you to do, but I haven't given up on you. And I love that she brings that to him. And I also love that Jesus still sees through to her heart and says, your brother will rise again. He's giving her a little bit of a challenge here. He's saying, how are you approaching me? He's probing her heart. Your brother will rise again. Because he wants her to say out loud what she believes. Because that's a really important step for our own hearts. And her answer kind of reveals her heart. She says, yes, Lord, I know he'll resurrect on the last day. She's approaching him as if his main job was a healer. If you had gotten here in time, you could have stopped this. But now I know we just have to wait for Resurrection Day. And how many times do we do this where we bring our prayers to God and we tell him, okay, because you didn't do this, now I know that this nothing can happen here. And I just have to wait till Resurrection Day. We do this a lot in our prayers with God. And I love that Jesus pushes her and he says, and basically he's saying, who do you say that I am? I'm asking you this question because I don't want to know what everybody else thinks about me. Martha, who do you say that I am? How are you approaching me? And he gives her what is one of the most beautiful I am statements in the Gospel of John. Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. In my presence, death has no power over you. I am the same God who formed Adam out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and Adam stood up and was a living soul. That's who I am, Martha. I'm not just a healer. I'm a resurrector. I'm not just a teacher. I'm the Messiah who has come to save you from the chains of your slavery to sin. This is who I am, Martha. Believe in me. And then he asks her, do you believe this? I want you to say it out loud in the face of your pain. I can't tell you how much this has held my heart together over the years. I struggle with terrible anxiety and fear. And there are times when I'm folding the clothes and my kids have been killed 3 different times at school in that moment by who knows what. My brain can go all the way down a road in a second, and I have to stop and say, no, who do I say that you are? I believe in you, that you are life here, right now, in the face of my pain, in the face of my fear, and I need to say it out loud. So I talk out loud to myself all the time at home. My husband works from home too, so it's kind of funny. He gets to hear me talk to me a lot. But I think that's really important for us to see here. Say it out loud. Who do you say that he is? Say it to your heart. Say it to his heart. Say it to the heart of your friends. Say it out loud. And I love that what I believe we are seeing here is Martha's salvation moment. I believe that she believed he was special, but maybe did not fully entrust her entire self to him until right now. And here's the other part I love about this. I'm going to say I love a lot because I really do love this passage. I love that he didn't raise Lazarus from the dead and then turn to Martha and say, do you believe this? Because it would have been easy to believe then. But this is the woman who is the doer. This is the woman who probably had set up every possible care that she could have thought of for Lazarus before he got to death's door. She probably had rubbed essential oils all over him and like given him a carcinogen-free diet for 6 months before this moment happened. Martha had done everything Martha could do. We know this because she calls Jesus when he's on his deathbed. She'd done everything on her own. This woman was tired of doing everything and carrying all the weight. And in this moment, Jesus says, I don't want you to wait until it all gets tied up and it's pretty bow on it for you to put your trust in me. I want you to believe now when you have empty hands before me and say, all of my doing did nothing. I believe in you because I have empty hands to receive all of you now. I love there's an old hymn that says, put your deadly doing down at Jesus's feet. We do a lot of doing in life. And sometimes we're called to, but a lot of times we're not. We are called to come to him with empty hands and say, I believe you are life in the middle of this pain. Not just when it all gets fixed in the end. I believe your life now, and I'm going to look expectantly for you to show up in whatever way you choose to show up, because I believe in you. And that's what we see here, this beautiful saving moment with Martha. And so really, I believe that Martha's story shows us that if we're willing to stay in the tension with God, if we're willing to bring our real disappointment, our real pain, and our faith, and we wrestle with him, we will come out victorious in the end, because we will come out on the other side holding him. And he is the greatest treasure our pain can offer us. Let's keep talking about this, because we're going to see even more. Why is that true in the way that Jesus interacts with Mary? And here, this here, I believe, is the glory, is where we're getting to. All right, so he has this interaction with Martha. Let's pick back up again. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days." Let's just stop there. That's kind of funny, because even when you come to Jesus, you still keep your doer personality. That's all right. I love it. She's like, "It's going to stink in there. Don't pull that stone." I didn't bring enough air freshener for that. All right. So Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." So I love this passage, because again, I think as people reading this in English, we miss a lot of the nuance that John is trying to convey to us here. And so I loved that there are commentators who tell us what the Greek words mean, because what we see when Jesus encounters Martha in her question, which if you notice, they were the exact same words, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died." He challenges Martha, because that's what Martha needs. Martha needs one final push to claim faith in him. When he sees Mary, who says the same words, Jesus responds with anger and with tears. And that's because that's what Mary needed. She needed his anger and she needed his tears. Now, I'm sure that as you hear me say that, you think anger. I don't see any anger in this passage. And that's because we're reading it in English. And if we were reading it in the Greek, we would exactly see that, because John uses a word that I cannot pronounce. And when we were doing this, this originally was a Bible study that I wrote for the women in my church. And when we got to this word, we called it embryo meow meow, but that's not it. But it kind of looks like that. An embryo meow meow is just fun to say. So, but that's what this word looks like. It's a Greek word, and it's a really interesting word. The commentators have a hard time, the translators have a hard time translating it. So here you'll see that Jesus was greatly moved. Deeply moved, greatly troubled in spirit is how they translate it. But what it literally means in the Greek, it's a word only used for animals snorting in rage. And that's so important for us to see, because this is telling us, John is, remember, he's 80 years old and he's reaching back to his 20-year-old self and he's saying, "What was that like? Oh, that thing I saw in Jesus, the only thing I can liken it to is a bull pawing at the ground snorting in rage. It's anger." Why would that be important for us? Because you and I, in the face of our pain, need to know that our God is angry at what we are suffering. Who is Jesus angry at here? Well, we see him get angry a second time in this passage because we see that word again, deeply moved, greatly troubled, as he is charging towards Lazarus's tomb because he's about to go into battle for his friend. Jesus is angry at death. He is angry at sin. He is angry at the chains that bind us because we were not created for this. Our Father didn't make us to die. He gave us souls that would last forever. And ever since we've been ejected from the garden, that wolf has been at our heels ever since, just nipping at us, taking chunks out of us. And when Jesus steps into our world, he says, "You don't get to claim dominion here anymore. They belong to me. I am the resurrection and the life. And in my presence, death, you don't exist. I will undo your power." And Jesus is going into battle for his friend. And in doing this, he's showing us what he will do for every single one of us. He will undo the power of death over us. Because Hebrews tells us, you and I live like fearful slaves. Because in the back of our mind, there's a ticking time clock. You know it. You feel it all the time. There's never enough time. Because we know an end is coming. That there will be a time when our eyes close here and we will be no more. And God looks at us and says, I don't want you to be a slave anymore. I don't want you to live in fear. And Hebrews says, because we lived in fear, our Father sent his Son who got into that prison with us and broke the bars from within and led us out into victory saying, you don't have to be afraid anymore because death has no claim over you. In my presence, it's just sleep. That's all it is. And so we see here that Jesus responds with anger because he is angry for all that we have suffered in this life, all that pain and sin and death have taken from us. And he snorts in rage when he reaches Lazarus's tomb because he is like an angry bull pawing at the ground about to charge his enemy and he will win. I love this because this is the Lion of Judah roaring over us, saying, they belong to me, and I will keep them safe. We need to hear him roar if we're ever going to be courageous in this life. So we first see him respond with anger. Then we see him respond with tears. This is actually one of my favorite verses because my mom was my Bible teacher when I was little, and we got Skittles for verses that we said, and Jesus wept is the shortest verse in the Bible, so I always got that one first, and I got a Skittle. So I like this verse. I liked this verse even more after I studied the Gospel of John because it tells us here that Jesus wept. Now, there were a lot of people crying. Because it says he looked around and he saw Mary weeping and the people who were around her weeping. And again, knowing the Greek is helpful because John uses a different word for Jesus's tears than the tears of everybody else around him. He uses a word that means to burst into tears. So it's Jesus surveying the calamity of what sin and death have done to us, throwing his head back and wailing in uncontrollable tears. I think we sometimes have these little picture book Bible visions of Jesus where he sort of shed a tear and wiped it away gently and then did something, said something really like calming. This is a picture of a God who, when he encounters your pain, he throws his head back and he wails. We need this in life. We need to know we have a God who weeps over us, who looks at your pain and feels it even more deeply than you do. Psalm 56 says, every single tear you've ever cried, he's caught it in a bottle and he's journaled it in his book. Your tears matter to him because your pain belongs to him too. Your pain is his pain. Jesus was the only one standing there that day who could say, Lazarus belongs to me. I lost him. You lost him too, but I lost him. His pain I feel on a deep gut level in my own heart. We see Jesus weeping over Lazarus, and I believe that he's weeping not just for Lazarus, but for all of us. Because he knows what sin and death have taken from us. He knows what it has cost us over the years to live in this broken world and to experience all this pain. And he's weeping over us. And we need to have a God who weeps, or we'll never trust his sovereignty. His power will never be a comfort to us unless we watch him wail over our pain. And that's so important. Remember, the whole point of Jesus coming that John is writing to us about is to show us what his Father is like. Because I think you and I tend to have this view of God that he's over all things. He sees all things. And kind of like, I often think about, I'm going to go on a little rabbit trail for a second. So Anne of Green Gables was my favorite movie growing up. Anybody else? Okay, thank you. All right, so you remember that scene where Anne accidentally dyes her hair green. And then she has to go to school to see Gilbert. And I, when the first time I saw that movie, I literally left the room. I was so like, oh, how mortifying that she would have green hair in front of cute Gilbert. You know, like just that tension. And I think we feel that. I mean, I feel that when I watch movies just because I get really emotionally caught up into movies and books. But I think we have this view of God that like, well, he knows the end of the story. I mean, I watch Anne of Green Gables now and I don't have to leave the room because I know that in the end she gets Gilbert and it's all going to be fine. But I think we often think that God approaches our lives, our stories in this way, that he's like, I know the end of this. I'm not going to worry about getting emotionally involved in this right now because I know it's going to turn out okay. We do that. I brought my beautiful 15-year-old daughter with me. But I know in parenting, sometimes I do that. I look at them and I think, this too shall pass. And I mean, we could get real emotionally involved in this right now, or I could save my energy for something else. But that's not how our God is. Because the reality of life is, what do we need? We've been talking about this already last night. We need a God who looks at us and says, I'm with you in this. It takes mental effort for me to say, I remember what it was like to be 15. And I know how bad this hurts. And I'm going to choose to curl up in bed with you right now and just be with you and cry with you because that's what you need in your mama right now. And that's what our God is saying to us. I'm not distant from your pain because I know the end of the story. I'm in the middle of it and I'm feeling it with you and I will undo it in the end. We need a God who sits with us in our pain and cries with us because then we won't see his waiting as being cruel. We will see his waiting as a time for him to be present with us until the time is right for him to move and to act on our behalf. We need a God who weeps if we're going to take any comfort in this life. But we need more than just a God who weeps. We also need a lion who roars. Because just a weeping God would be a sentimental Hallmark Jesus. And we need more than that. If we're going to be more than conquerors in this life, we need to watch him weep over us, but then we need to hear him roar in the face of our pain. This, to me, has been one of the most healing things about this chapter, that when I am in the throes of anxiety, because you can't really reason with fear. And John will write later in one of his epistles, 1 John, it's perfect love that drives out fear. You don't reason with fear. It has to be driven out by love. And when I am in the middle of anxiety, I literally picture, I'm going to have to move away from the mic.
I picture myself standing there and the Lion of Judah hovering over me and roaring in the face of the thing that has me crippled in fear. This is the God we have. A God who stands over us and says, you don't get to keep her. She belongs to me. And if you're going to get her, you're going to have to come through me. So just go ahead and try. That's the God we have.
I love that picture of our God. We need a God who stands over us, who says, she is my treasure. You don't get to have her today. We need a God who stands over us and roars over us if we are ever going to be courageous to even walk out our doors every morning. This is the God that we see here. Jesus is revealing who his Father is, a God who weeps over you and a God who stands over you and roars because you belong to him and everything about you is precious to him. And he will defend you even till the end of the age. This is the picture that we have here. In our pain, we must see Jesus weep, but we must also hear him roar. And know that we serve a champion. It's a champion standing over us. It's a champion who knows what it's like to be wounded, who stands over us and defends us. Paul later wrote
in Romans and all these things. And this is after he's writing about trials and tribulations. In all of these trials and tribulations, we are more than what? We are more than conquerors through him who loved us. What is more than a conqueror? It's a champion. You and I are called to live the lives of little champions because we know that big champion stands over us, that that big champion goes before us, that he's fought our fight, that he's won our battle, that he hems us in from behind, that he stands next to us and defends us. This is our God seen in the face of Jesus Christ. We have a champion, and that's why we can be more than conquerors through him who loved us. And if we are willing to step out in faith, to not try to escape the tension in this life, but to sit with him in it, we will see his glory. God will show up in ways unimaginable, and we will see pieces and parts of his heart that we never saw before, that we never would have seen if we had just tried to run away from the pain all the time. But if we sit there, we'll see his glory, we'll see his heart, and we will know that he is a God for us. He's in our corner, on our side, a champion who fights for us. And this is what gives us the courage to move forward in this life because we know the end of the story and we can pull back and see it and entrust all of ourselves to him. So, challenge you to steward your pain and suffering well. Don't waste it. Bring it to the one who can make it something so much more than just pain and suffering, who can actually make it into something powerful and beautiful. Let's pray. God, we thank you for this picture that we see of you. We thank you that you are a God who roars over us, that your voice drowns out fear, that you drive it out, you beat it out of our existence, out of our experience. But you are also a God who tenderly weeps over us. So God, for those of us who are sitting here today that are experiencing hard things, I pray that they would feel your tears, that they would hear your wails and know that you feel deeply this pain and the suffering that they experience. And God, for those of us who feel discouraged, who feel that our lives could not change and that this pain and suffering is here to stay, God, would we hear you roar and that your roar over us would break our chains and that we could walk out of these doors like champions because that is who we are in you because you have gone before us. You are such a good big brother, such a good older brother to have done all of these things for us. We just follow behind you in your path of victory. Thank you for who you are. Thank you for experiencing pain for us so that you could comfort us in the middle of our pain and that you could take our pain, plant it deep within your own heart and grow something truly beautiful out of it. God, help us to trust you. This takes real faith. So Holy Spirit, we need your help. Help us to see you as you truly are and help us to entrust all of ourselves to you so that one day we can stand next to Mary and Martha and Lazarus before the throne of the Lamb with tears in our eyes saying, wasn't he good? He was so good. Look at what he did for us. We look forward to that day. Wait for it expectantly. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.